WNST, Towson Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. All of our Baltimore Positive programming and broadcasting usually involves a spoon in the ice cream of our friends at Taharka. Awaken more than just your taste buds, the award-winning ice cream, serving up social change and made right here in Baltimore to get in my belly. I had a long conversation on the internet about the merits of vanilla bean ice cream. I'll get to that a little later on. That it doesn't have to be all wake and bake and honey graham. Just vanilla bean sometimes is perfect. Chocolate love as well. Our friends over at State Fair in Catonsville, where we usually have these kinds of conversations, along with many, many local people. We've been doing that for about a year and a half, 250 episodes now, Baltimore Positive. We haven't been able to get to State Fair in Catonsville. We haven't been able to get to Fadley's, but you can certainly get there. We can't sit there 6 feet away with masks on, so we're doing it this way. But we highly encourage you to order those crab cakes at Fadley's and ship them. Stop out at State Fair and say hello. They're going to be neighbors soon in the same parking lot out in Catonsville. Speaking of Catonsville, Mueller and Gary Realty, still closing deals, still listing houses from 6 feet away and closing deals. These interest rates are incredible. I had Jeff Mueller on the show last week. We talked about that. Don, I'm going to allow you to, from Catonsville, to introduce a guy who's no stranger to the Beltway, doing it at the Baltimore Sun before, long before I was doing it at the Baltimore Sun back in the 70s. I was there in the 80s. We were colleagues at one point, but I want you to do the honors on this one.
Well, if people have been following the news in Maryland for more than a year or two, they're very familiar with our next guest, Barry Raskobar, a longtime Sun reporter, WYPR, you name it. All over the place, currently very active. You can subscribe to his articles, to his blogs at politicalmaryland.com. Barry's always thoughtful, always gives you something to chew on. And Barry, welcome to Baltimore Positive.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Don and Esther.
Well, we've been chasing folks around, you know, a year and a half and doing this since I moved from sports in 3 decades to saying, who's going to be our next mayor? You know, how's this going to run? And then this coronavirus comes in, and all of these things that we've talked about from a political nature about Kerwin and, you know, what we're going to do about policing in this country and all of it has been sort of in a stop set here over the last 6 months as this country tries to tackle a war with a virus and a pathogen that it cannot see and in many cases just truly doesn't understand, right?
Oh, that's correct. I mean, this is a time that everyone will remember. It used to be that Don's generation, they talked about, remember Pearl Harbor. Everybody knew exactly where they were that day. Growing up, I know exactly where I was when I heard the news that Kennedy had been shot. Everybody will remember 2020. They'll know exactly what they were doing, or rather what they weren't doing, for a full year. Because this is something that, in the Middle Ages, all of us would be dead by now from some pestilence. So we're very fortunate that the vast majority of us will live to talk about this.
And yet through the ages, we've had science and Don was my high school guidance counselor at Dundalk High School back in 1982, Barry. So
my condolences.
Well, and
what Barry might suggest that. But I do not remember Pearl Harbor, but I do remember clearly being in eighth grade the day John Kennedy was shot, and remember the nuns crying in the hallway at St. Mark's. So yeah, we do certainly have seminal moments that we remember in history.
Well, and I would say about the science part of this and the education part of this, and in the modern era where social media can be a game of phone booth about a pathogen that we have now, over 6 months, completely politicized, a pathogen, a plague, literally, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to look abroad to see what happened there, because in Great Britain, you had a Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, which was following basically the Donald Trump model of denial until he caught the virus himself and nearly died. And suddenly he turned around, 180-degree turnaround, and look at Great Britain. They're on the downward slope now. Reopening is a thing that's working there. In this country, we just have 50 different quasi-solutions, and we're spinning our wheels to a large extent. Look at Look at what's happening with Major League Baseball now, for goodness sakes.
Well, now you've just touched on a topic near and dear to Nestor's heart, because he's trying to make sense of what is happening in Major League
Baseball. Well, I'm making sense of it is that the money is leading the way, and I've been thinking a lot about this in the first 48 hours of the mess and the Yankees coming to town and Manfred, that this is literally, from a political standpoint, it's sort of where Trump is in running the country and going to jail or not, right, or winning an election. It's no matter what. We're going to send these kids back into classrooms. We're going to send these teachers back. We're going to send baseball back. We're going to cut your unemployment. We're going back no matter what.
But
that feels like the baseball football scenario to me. It feels like no matter what.
Yeah, the problem here is that you now have 50 governors who are really in charge of what happens on the health front, not the President of the United States, who has walked away from this. He doesn't understand the problem to begin with. Unless he can control a situation, he doesn't want to deal with it. And he cannot control a virus of this sort. The virus is in control. So he's turned it over to the states. So we have 50 different solutions. With baseball, it could well be that Larry Hogan is going to decide whether the Orioles have a season or not. And right on down the line for the other 29 teams.
Now, Barry, it's interesting for folks who might just be becoming familiar with you now through Political Maryland and have not followed your work over the years. You may reject what I'm about to say, and I'll give you an opportunity to reject it if you would like, but your reputation over the years from people on my side of the aisle in terms of the government side has been a guy who has not been seen as a typical, what folks would say and be critical if you were a Republican, a left-leaning member of the media. At the same time, you have not been seen by Democrats as sort of a Fox News devotee. You've been seen as sort of this right down the middle guy who might write a positive article about a Democrat today and a negative article about a Republican tomorrow, and then a nice article about a Republican and a negative article, sort of an umpire calling balls and strikes. I mean, is that a fair description of the way you think you've been seen over the years?
Yes, I think it is. I like to subscribe to the Hyman Rickover theory, which was, he was the great naval admiral who pioneered nuclear submarines. And Jimmy Carter was working under him and was called in one day and was called on the carpet for something he had done. And Carter said he thought he had done everything right, and Rickover replied, "Why not the best?" And that's the way I look at elected leaders. Why can't they get together and resolve problems that are affecting people? Why can't the governor do a better job? So over the years, I basically have been very tough on governors, asking them to do better than they think they are doing, to be less political, less partisan, and more cooperative to get things done. So, I think every governor I have written about has not liked what I've written about them, that I'm too hard on them. Whether it's a Paris Glendening or a Bob Ehrlich, it doesn't really matter. They just don't seem to like the things I write, because I'm not one to overly praise people. I just am not. I started my career at the Baltimore Sun, and my political career began in 1971, covering William Donald Schaefer and his campaign that year for the Sun. Schaefer and I fought throughout his career. He never thought he was getting enough good publicity, but he had a lot of Trumpian characteristics, but he also was a do-it-now mayor and governor, which, I applauded him for. But he always remembered the slights and the negatives, and you know, I've just come to expect that that's the way it's going to go, that politicians are always going to be less than pleased with what I probably say about them, because I am tough on them, because I expect them to do the best, not just better.
Barry Raskivar is our guest. You know of him if you have followed local journalism. And Barry, it's interesting you bring this up because, you know, my background, I worked at the paper back when I was a kid. I mean, I was 17 years old joining the Baltimore Washington Newspaper Guild when we were striking and picketing out in front and, you know, trying to get more money for the union and for the guild. And I was 19 years old at that time. And there was a real career in journalism then. You know, the Jack Gibbons and the guys over on the sports side that brought me up the right way to who, what, where, why, when, how, question, ask again, ask three times, get three sources. Just because the coach tells you it's not true. You know, make sure it's true. And before you put it in the paper, and you had your name next to it. Don and I have talked to so many reporters, you know, in the 2 years we've been doing this together. And where journalism is and where it's perceived to be in some quarters and what is accepted as a fact or accepted as a news source in the modern era has really made for a very, very broken, weird America right now. And having the Baltimore Suns of the world lose people like you, lose good people throughout the generation, and to have that 19-year-old kid in me look at the industry of telling the truth about what government is doing as something that might not be a real viable career from how do I feed my family, I really do worry about that. And I worry about the Sun, and we spent most of last week talking about furloughs and whatnot with Pam Wood.
Yeah. The Baltimore Sun is very much an endangered species unless some way can be found to shake the Sun loose from Tribune Publishing, because Tribune Publishing, it looks like, is going to be in the hands of a Vulture Capital fund very shortly, at which point what's left of the Baltimore Sun will be shredded even more so. You know, the journalism today, very, very different from when I started. It's a transformational process, and we don't know how it's going to shake out. The Internet has turned journalism upside down. The good news is that people still need to find out what's happening in their community, in their town, in their region, in their state. And somebody has to deliver that information to them. Now, how you do that in a model that is profitable or at least breaks even, that's the open, unanswered question. A few publications have figured it out. The New York Times, you know, I was up at a conference last year at Columbia University. The editorial page, one of the top editors at the Times was on a panel discussion, and she said they had 4.5 million digital subscribers. 4.5 million. That's an astounding number if you put that together with what an annual subscription costs to their digitally to the New York Times. They are making out very well. They have figured it out. Unfortunately, the smaller publications like the Baltimore Sun, their owners have not figured it out. So it's a question of, you know, when, you know, a lot of journalistic publications will understand how you take the Internet and monetize the Internet for distributing information of the communities where you live. Once that happens, journalism does a U-turn and suddenly looks like it's a growth industry again.
Well, Barry, I know that your heart is it's underway. What does your head tell you about the opportunities for nonprofits for a paper like the Baltimore Sun?
I think those are going to be rare opportunities because it depends on people within a given community who have made a lot of money being willing to give up some of that money to keep the local newspaper in town and thriving. We have people like that in the Baltimore region. whether they would be willing to come together and figure out how they could create such a nonprofit model. That's the question. And then the other question, which is even more difficult, is how you wrench the Baltimore Sun out of the hands of Tribune Publishing. So it may take a while, but I think that the nonprofit model is viable if you have people with very deep pockets who are willing to put up the money to create a nonprofit. Because, you know, for a number of years, you're going to have to be putting money in and not taking money out or even breaking even as a nonprofit. Somebody's going to have to be filling the gap in there, because right now, on the financial side, the business side, newspapers are not where you want to put your money if you want to make a profit.
For you, what you do at politicalmaryland.com, and I think this is, you know, what I do at Baltimore Positive, and I think there will always be local people looking to someone they trust for information. You know, I've come to that conclusion during the Trump era that there will be another day, there will be a day after this virus, and I think one of the things over the next decade we'll see in the 20s that I believe is people looking for trusted resources, right? Like someone with experience, wisdom, someone that, as Don Mohler would say, calls balls and strikes fairly.
Right, and I think, you know, people will disagree on whether that's you would classify the New York Times in that category, but I would. It's still not the New York Times of 30 years ago, but it is still a trusted, fact-driven journalistic institution. There's got to be a reason that 4.5 million people take their digital newspaper. And the reason is they can trust what they read in there, that the information has been vetted, that, you know, there has been fact-checking. There has been a copy desk to go over the copy, editors who will question reporters as to where did you get this information from, how viable is it, do you have it sourced from more than one person, and so forth. I agree with you that people want to go to trusted sources for their information. It used to be that you could turn on Walter Cronkite and you knew that, you know, the NBC News or the CBS News or the ABC News would give you, down the line news reporting. That's less so today. I mean, I watch the evening news all the time. I find it less and less a really good source of news. It's now quasi-entertainment to a degree. There's almost no focus on foreign or international reporting, maybe one story during a half-hour broadcast. Eventually we're going to turn the corner on this, and we'll get back to, a more straightforward reporting on the domestic and international scenes. But at the moment, this country is so inner-driven now. I mean, you know, all we care about is making America great or making America greater or making America something, but the rest of the world is just being ignored.
Well, yeah, it really is a remarkable time, Barry. Jumping back to the issue of balls and strikes and your back and forth with governors over the years, Nestor and I, and Nestor has had a positive relationship with Governor Hogan over the years, particularly related to the cancer issues that the governor had and Nestor's wife's been through. We were very complimentary of the governor at the beginning of the COVID crisis. He was a direct contrast to the president of the United States. But then, as always from my perspective, this seems to happen with Governor Hogan. We then go veer off into these other lanes, whether it's a veto of Kerwin and a veto of school construction. Most recently,
his decision that really caught us off guard about the upcoming election, and you wrote about it, and you actually, since I'm assuming you're actually even writing the headlines for your articles, you challenged the governor, said he was actually engaging in voter suppression. Talk about that most recent article a little bit.
Yeah, well, I'm now formulating another article that goes a step further, that Hogan could be creating on November the 3rd an absolute disaster, a debacle the likes of which we've never seen in Maryland, where voting is so messed up, people are going to wonder, how did Hogan allow this to happen? I think he may be at a point that unless he changes his mind and allows for mail-in ballots, that his popularity may reverse course, that this may be his Waterloo as far as Marylanders are concerned. Now, he doesn't have to worry about that in Maryland because he can't run again for governor. But I think his approval-disapproval rating may be about to take a change. And I'll tell you something else. On the COVID crisis, you know, I wrote a number of columns praising the heck out of Hogan for the way he had handled it. But look at what he's done over the last month. He's reversed course there, too. He's politicized it. He has done what Trump has done. He has turned decision-making over to the county executives and county commissioners. And
many times they were informed via Twitter as to what the plans were going to be, literally.
Right, right. I mean, you know, it's a mess. And we're headed in the same direction as states, the southern states, the Sun Belt states, where they've had very little direction from their governors. And you can see what's happened there. And our numbers, you know, have not been looking good on the COVID front. You know, we're in the middle of summertime, and people are, you know, especially young people, are not obeying the rules. They're just not. Where is the governor on this? He's disappeared. I think that's a political move. He is now, every move he makes.
Well, he can't wag his finger at his own people. You know, politically, he doesn't have the instinct to be able to say, we're doing this wrong, you're doing this wrong.
Well, I'm going to push back on both of you. This is where we love Baltimore Positive, and you guys both correct me. If I'm in his political room, Barry, and I'm giving him advice, I would be saying that if he's trying to do what you and Nestor are suggesting, which is to become, quote-unquote, more Trump-like in hopes of running in 2024, I would suggest to him that that's a lane that he's not going to have any room for. There's not going to be enough space for him there. There's going to be a Tom Cotton there. There's going to be a Nikki Haley there. There's going to be a Ted Cruz there. That lane is going to be taken up. And I would be saying, Governor, I don't know if we can get there my way, but you're not going to get there being Trump-like. You'd have to be this, you'd have to portray yourself in the wake, assuming that Trump loses, and we'll have you talk about that shortly, in trying to put the party back together again as a guy from a blue state who had the highest popularity of any governor in the nation, saying we can do this a different way. Politically, I don't understand the advice he's getting, Barry. So Kurt, what am I missing?
I don't think you're missing anything. I think the advice he's being given is that you have to ingratiate yourself with the Republican base as much as you can, and that one of the things that's not going to help him is that if he makes any more tough coronavirus decisions that closes down the state's businesses or its bars or something, suddenly the Republican base, even in Maryland, is going to be extremely unhappy.
By the way, I go back to sports with this now, Barry. I mean, no matter what, right? Those bars are going to stay open no matter what. I mean, and that to me feels like where we take our lead from baseball and these other places, the no matter what thing is what's getting people killed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But they did. They don't want to recognize that. They don't want to take responsibility for that. And that's where a leader has to step forward, like Andrew Cuomo has done in New York State, and made some extremely unpopular decisions. And suddenly, Maryland's governor is pushing that off to the county executives and to the mayor. You know, when Jack Young decided to reimpose certain restrictions in Baltimore City, that's when the governor should have backed him up completely and said, you know, good job, Mr. Mayor. But, of course, this governor doesn't say anything good about Baltimore City. That's another subject for another day.
No, that's not. That's why Baltimore Positive got started, Barry. I mean, no. I live at the harbor. The reason I'm doing this is I had my home on the market for 2 years, and no one walked through it. You know, no one made, like, any offer at all. And
well, Nestor, clean it up.
I know. It's what you got to do.
Put new carpet down.
Well,
paint the place.
Cleaning up the city and the image of the city when every night I live in the city and watch what is broadcast to the suburbs and the perception of the city and the perception of Squeegee Boys and the perception of why would I go to Little Italy if I live in Bel Air when I can go to Applebee's or whatever it would be, that the city, and I look out the window every day from the baseball stadium to the football stadium, to seeing crowds less down here the last 3, 4, 5 years, to seeing businesses shuttered like Reggie's in my neighborhood, which was my Cheers bar, you know, I felt like Larry Hogan now sits there and is he pro Baltimore or is he not? Well, I mean, a year and a half we've been trying to get him on the show, and he's doing a book tour now. He's all over my television. He doesn't really want to sit down with Don and I and talk about Baltimore so much, or sit down with anybody from Baltimore and talk about Baltimore so much.
No, he's clearly focused on his political future, and that doesn't include dealing with Baltimore. It's more about dealing with the national media, national Republicans, and trying to figure out where the Republican Party is going to be in 4 years. And he's rolling the dice, saying that, well, you know, sanity will return to the Republican Party in 4 years, and they'll be looking for a more moderate to go up against either Joe Biden or some other Democrat, and to bring back to the Republican side independents and more conservative Democrats that are likely to desert Republicans this year. That's the decision he seems to have made, that he's going to take a chance that he can steer through a very narrow channel to the Republican nomination. But if I were in the room with Don and the governor, I'd tell him to give up on that dream. I think it's a pipe dream. I think 4 years from now, that Donald Trump will still be in charge of the Republican Party, and that it'll either be Donald running for vindication in 2024, or Ivanka, or Don Jr., or whoever that Donald...
Come on, hey, he woke up, they threw him off Twitter this morning. How the hell is he going to run for president, you know?
Well, Barry, let me push back on it as well, because you've been, you know, when you talk to folks, you've been pretty open. You're one of the people that's more and more indicating that you believe that there is about to be a complete repudiation of Donald Trump on November the 3rd. And correct me if I'm wrong when we go forward with this premise. And then I ask you, if there's repudiation of Donald Trump on November the 3rd, as you're predicting, why then would the Republican Party and the base go in the same direction 4 years later? As a political guru, walk us through that.
The Republican Party is now totally controlled by Trump and his machine. That will not change on November the 4th. It just will not. And Trump, if you look at his personality, his mental characteristics, he's someone who never backs down, never backs away, never admits defeat, and always pushes forward aggressively. And I think if he indeed loses the election, I think after the Inauguration Day, he will probably start his own network, or become a regular on Fox News, and he will start immediately campaigning against the Democratic administration as the titular head of the Republican Party. How do you dislodge him? That's the question. You know, I quite frankly, I wonder how long the Ted Cruz's of the party and the Cottons of the party and the Larry Hogans of the party, for that matter, how long can they keep going down this road being led into dead end after dead end by Donald Trump? I'm not sure that the Republican Party, as it now exists, will be there in 4 or 8 years, because the demographics of this country are changing quite dramatically. And in 4 or 8 or 12 years, unless the Republican Party changes its tune, it could go the way of the Whig Party.
But the voter base of the suppressed people are voting on the Democratic side. And the one thing Hogan can certainly do to wink in their direction is to hold a crooked election on November 3rd that people can't even get out and vote, like they did in Milwaukee a couple of months ago.
Well, he can try, but the problem is that every single poll has shown that the voter intensity, that is, you know, how positive are you you're going to vote this time, is sky high. They've never recorded numbers like this in polls historically before, this high. People are going to get out and vote. That's bad news for the Republicans and Trump, because they're outnumbered. They're just outnumbered. So I think regardless of what voter suppression is tried, people are going to find a way to vote. But then afterwards, in Maryland, I think they're going to express their intense anger over the individual who forced them to risk their health in order to vote. And that suddenly Larry Hogan may be on the wrong side of that issue. He may be on the wrong side of the COVID issue by then. Plus, I think if the election is really messed up, that the General Assembly next year will strip Larry Hogan of his power to run elections. They'll turn it over to a nonpartisan commission.
The part of that, Barry, when you talk, I just shake my head, is the reasons that the governor has cited. And again, you write about it, but the reasons that he cited for his decision, which was really a decision, it was the one option that the local boards of elections asked him not to choose, because they told him that they did not have the manpower to handle two mailings, which he's now put them in the middle of having to do two mailings. And he cited things like, well, ballots came out late and some of the ballots got directed. Those things were easily fixable compared to the situation that he's now created.
Right. It's totally unfixable. It's unfixable. You're not going to have enough sites to locate polling places. You just won't in a COVID era. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to have. Where is Larry Hogan going to come up with 14,000 more poll workers, election judges, around the state? And the fact is that half of them have to be Republicans. Try to do that in Baltimore City, for instance, where you have a dearth of Republicans to begin with. Most of the ones that have been working the polls are elderly. They're not going to risk dying in order to be an election judge. So, I mean, he set this up for failure. And I just think...
And he knows that. He knows that, right? He must know that.
I think he's going to hear cheers from Republicans across the country. That's what he expects, because he didn't allow a mail-in ballot. And he will say, well, mail-in ballots, fraud can happen there, so we didn't do it. I insisted on a traditional ballot, and then the Democrats messed it up. And that's what he's going to tell the Republicans, you know, that I was faithful to the cause. I did try to keep the Democratic vote down in Maryland. I'm a loyal Republican. I don't think it flies. I think Hogan is, whoever is whispering in his ear should stop whispering, because he's getting very bad advice.
And the problem with that
scenario, Barry, is that I think we would all agree that up to this point, whoever's been whispering in his ear, and listen, I was on the other side of that aisle. I mean, I was trying to elect my friend Kevin Kamenetz. You know, we were ready to go, you know, full bore ahead when that tragedy took place. But one of the things we always acknowledged in the meeting was that Larry Hogan had an incredible political team that knew how to tap into the hearts and minds of the Maryland electorate. So that's why this seems a little discordant to me. I agree with you. Something seems amiss. And that doesn't even get into, Barry, a topic that nobody writes about better than you. And I've said this for years. You do a better job of explaining state finances and local government finances than almost anybody that I read. And I'm going to ask you just straight out, does anyone have a clue as to what kind of really financial distress state and local governments are about to experience as a result of COVID, Barry?
No, because the worst is going to come next year, and we're not going to know how bad the damage is until after April 15th, and the returns start coming in to the treasurer's office in Annapolis, the controller's office. That's when we're going to really find out how bad it is, because I know for myself, for a variety of reasons, my income is a fraction of what it was the year before, and I think that's going to happen right on down the line. State government is going to be in a heck of a serious bind, in large measure, because we have a governor who refuses to even hear the words tax increase. He won't hear of it. Given that, and given the deficit hole that is probably going to be gigantic next year, on top of the deficit that they're running, the huge deficit they're running now, I just wonder what in the world is going to happen. I mean, Martin O'Malley, when he faced this during the Great Recession, had the courage to raise taxes. Larry Hogan doesn't want to touch it because that will hurt his presidential ambitions in 2024.
So then, Barry, we show back up. I want you to keep going with this because this is why we started Baltimore Positive, to become educated. So we're going to come back in January, and the first order of business is going to be to override three vetoes: Kerwin, Built to Learn, and HBCU. Total price tag, when you put them together, of just under $7 billion. How does that all play out?
I think what they do is override the vetoes, and then they modify in the 2021 legislative session that Kerwin gets stretched out a little bit, for instance, that the historic black universities and colleges, that may get stretched out a little bit. But it's going to be up to the Democrats in the General Assembly to have the courage to raise taxes considerably, because otherwise the governor's not going to take the lead on that. He's just going to slash government programs to the bone and then into the bone. And I think it's going to be a royal mess. I'm not so sure that leadership in the General Assembly now is experienced enough or wise enough to handle this situation well. It used to be that you know, you had your Mike Millers, you had your Mike Bushes, you had your Casper Taylors, you had your Ben Cardens. You know, these are people who understood finances. These are people who understood how government worked. And you know, if the legislature had to bail us out of the savings and loan debacle because the governor wasn't fully up to it, they did it. They did it, and they did it well. I just wonder if, Adrian Jones and Bill Ferguson and their teams are of that quality. There's not much experience there on the bench, but I think they're going to have to step up big time, because the governor is going into a shell, really, because that's the best way to protect his hopes for 2024.
Now,
go ahead.
I'll push back a little bit, and again, we've had both the Senate president and the speaker on, and I would say that I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised at how they manage these, and again, the proof will be in the pudding, but...
Well, we don't even know what we're managing, right, Don? I mean, from a shortfall perspective.
We're going to see leadership that surprises folks, and it's very, very difficult when you follow the two mics. But I think the early reports are very, very positive, and I think people are going to be pleasantly surprised when they see the kind of leadership that's exerted on both sides down there in the General Assembly. But we will find out. That'll be a topic for another day.
Yeah, I think the problem that both Ferguson and Jones face is going to be very similar to what we're going to see in Washington if Joe Biden is elected. How does he control the radical left of his party? Or is that radical left going to seize control of the issues and try to dominate rather than allow the president to lead? And I think that's going to be the problem for Jones and Ferguson, that the radical left in that legislature may be unwilling, for instance, to raise taxes on the middle class.
Is there a middle lane left down there anymore, Barry, in your perception?
Somewhat. But I think somebody, for instance, like Ferguson, who came up as a hard left liberal, is learning that moderation is a virtue, not a vice. And I think Mike Miller was whispering in his ear throughout that first session, and I think he's learning that lesson, that, you know, being in the center of the road has its advantages, especially if you're leading a chamber which wants to tug you far to the left. So, you know, it's going to be a real challenge for them. But, you know, this 2021 could be a historic year for legislators and the governor in Maryland because of the financial mess that they're going to have to deal with.
Barry Raskivar, covering all things politics and Maryland for a long, long time at the Baltimore Sun, YPR, amongst others. You can find him now at politicalmaryland.com. Barry, next time we get together, we're going to have some shrimp and grits or some chicken and waffles or some crab cakes at Fadley's or State Fair, maybe even over El Guapo. Hopefully we get through this pandemic thing and stay safe throughout all of this.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you, Barry.
Okay, thanks to both of you.
On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. Together, we are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. Calm, local, and always Baltimore positive.